Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape it on Friday morning. We're going to begin with a poem by Lynn Ekdahl, our political poet. It's entitled, The Media's At It Again. There's great power in cable and pen, and mainstream media's at it again. For some reason, their high moral sense propels them to equivalence. So for each of the Don's diatribes, Biden's flaws they're compelled to describe. I'm your vengeance, says Trump to great cheers. Biden's old, in the paper appears. There'll be blood in the baths if I lose. Biden's tired, appears in the news. Immigrants are just vermin, Don mutters. Oh no, did you hear? Biden stutters. It's equivalence false, and it's glaring. It's apples to cabbage comparing. There are serious things to compare. Women's rights, assault rifles, clean air. Beyond that, there's the frightening potential of a threat that may be existential if the Donald's elected again. God forbid of democracy, he may well get rid. So clean up your act, media, please. You're making a lot of us queasy candidates and their issues compare in a manner complete, smart, and fair. Joining us now for our Rethink the Week is our fabulous panel of guests. We have Stephen Pimpare, who is now a professor of public policy at the at Vermont Law School and Public Policy Graduate School. And I want to welcome Stephen Pimpare back to the program. How are you, Stephen?
Thank you. I'm doing well, Arnie.
And congratulations on your new gig, by the way.
Thank you.
So yeah, it's exciting. And as an alumnus of Vermont Law School, I'm incredibly excited for you. And we also are joined by Laura Jadid. Laura Jadid is a freelance journalist who primarily focuses on the American conservative movement. Her bylines include The New Republic, Rolling Stone, and New York Magazine. Also joining us is Lincoln Mitchell. Lincoln Mitchell is a professor at Columbia University. You can read him in many places, including the San Francisco Examiner, CNN. And if you want more of Lincoln, you can go to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be here recording on Friday morning. Brings my week together.
I'm sure. It's the end of the week. Hey, and joining us finalmente is Ron Abramson. Ron Abramson is a fabulous immigration lawyer. He is with Shaheen and Gordon. Ron, as you pointed out just when I was about to introduce you, he said if it's an election season, everything comes back to immigration law and what's happening with the border. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Arnie. Every Friday with you is a good Friday.
Oh, thank you. It actually is a good Friday. Ding, ding. All right, everyone. I read that poem by Lynn Ekdahl, but in a lot of ways, it was kind of a way of my teeing up this story. As we all know, NBC News had decided to hire Rona Romney McDaniel as a paid consultant or a participant on NBC News on all their platforms, by the way, because everyone at NBC agreed to this. And then all of a sudden, the blowback was incredible, not only from people that were on the set of NBC and MSNBC, but it turned out that the public at large said, what the hell are you doing giving a $300,000 contract to Rona McDaniel, especially since the stench of MAGA had not even left her. And as a result, they made a decision just this week to or last week to remove her and no longer put her on the payroll. But what I thought was absolutely fascinating, and I'm going to start with you, Laura Jadid, because you're the journalist in the family. And that is that as a result of the decision by the NBC to remove the contract from Rona Romney McDaniel, it turns out that the RNC is now threatening to limit NBC's access to their summer Republican convention. And I read this and I was like, huh, is this a threat? Does this prove that Rona was really part of the sort of the MAGA concept and this was all about access and getting MAGA threaded even more into the coverage of news by NBC and MSNBC? But I thought it was kind of interesting because what will they actually be missing if they don't have access to this summer convention? Because we know what it's going to be. It's going to be all fascist all the time and it's going to be about revenge. And as Ron Abramson said before we began the show, it's going to be all about migrants, all right? Because it's all immigration policy. But I'm kind of curious as to your reaction with the threat of access to their summer convention. Everything is about access, unfortunately, when it comes to, frankly, not just Republicans, but all politicians.
It boggles the mind what they did. For me, it's basically where they have ended up is exactly where they started, but worse. If they hadn't hired her in the first place, they wouldn't be mad at her. But they did hire her, and then everybody had the exact predictable reaction, and then they fired her, and now everyone's mad at them. I'm it's really hard for me to feel bad for NBC in this situation. I'll be honest. They played this very poorly. They hired somebody who is complicit, not just like, oh yeah, the election was stolen in 2020, but explicit in the attempt to steal that election. And now, yeah, now they might lose access to the Republican National Convention. I kind of agree that, I mean, I don't know how big of a, it doesn't seem great for a major news organization to be barred. I'm not sure it's going to happen. It looks like the logistics of that actually happening would be very difficult. I doubt it will actually happen. But I mean, again, this is, you know, NBC made their bed, and it's a weird bed they made, and I hope they enjoy it because I don't know why they'd make it.
Well, let me just say something. So Lincoln Mitchell, every Friday we hang out with the Quorum Report, which covers Texas politics. And this Friday, what was so interesting is that what we're hearing now about the RNC limiting access to NBC because of their decision to terminate the contract with Rona Romney McDaniel actually parallels something that's going on in Texas. Now, it turns out that the gentleman that was on with me, who's the publisher of the Quorum Report, sent me what you need to produce for media access to the 2024 Texas Republican Convention in San Antonio, Texas. So I want to show you that there's a theme going on here, okay? It's not just the RNC saying to NBC, you know, maybe you're not going to be able to cover our convention. Listen to this part of the requirements for application for media accreditation at the Republican Party of Texas. It's number 4. Present the Republican Party of Texas with sufficient evidence, not business cards or membership cards from communications or writers organizations, to demonstrate eligibility and purpose, including evidence that attendance is expected to result in factual coverage of the meeting in print, broadcast, or internet media. Demonstrate writings about the Republican Party of Texas or related political issues in the previous year. And so the guy who sent this to me said, what does that mean, Arnie? Does that mean that if we have basically accused members of the Republican Party in Texas of lying, of providing factual untruths, of trying to distort the facts, of trying to undermine what they are telling the voters, that that kind of information that we've provided to our readership will now be viewed through the Republican Party of Texas as perhaps a reason not to grant us eligibility or media access to the Republican convention? I mean, look what's going on here. So if we call a lie, we are now not being factual, except you are being factual. But now, since facts have no meaning, the Republican Party of Texas can say, well, we're going to pull your credentials. I just want people to see there is something going on here, and it's not just the RNC.
And there's something going on that I believe is a little more important here also, which is that, you know, not having access to the RNC convention, you know, if it were like on a personal level, I would consider that a gift. I would consider that I get another week of my life back in the middle of the summer. And if I were writing about it, and I will write about it on my Substack, and I will comment on it here and elsewhere, I can follow it in the media. I don't need to be there.
Yeah.
What concerns me is that this spills over into access to government, you know, access for the media to affairs of government, which are important. Right. So if, and I don't want to say this out loud, but if Donald Trump becomes president again, we know that he will not give access to media that is reporting in the sense of telling what happened truthfully. He will give access to his propaganda outlets. And we saw that in the first time Trump was president. We will see that in Republicans. So if they're doing it at the RNC, what do you need to do to get into a press conference in Oklahoma, in Texas, where the governor or the state legislature? So this is moving in that direction, restricting First Amendment rights. And the media freedom that's most important here for the purposes of this discussion is the ability to be there and cover what is happening in government, in the legislature, in the executive branch, at the judiciary, et cetera, et cetera. I want to just go back to two other brief points here. One we've talked about before, which is that there is this kind of false equivalency in how we understand the media.
Yes, yes.
NBC or MSNBC or the New York Times even could be described as media that is more sympathetic to the Democrats and the Republicans. Some might push back against that, but I think that many people would see it that way. Fox is a propaganda outlet. OAN is a propaganda outlet. These are not the same things. And that frames us. The second point is what we see with NBC with this just dreadful handling from beginning, you know, If they'd never made the stupid mistake of hiring her, as Laura Jadid pointed out, they wouldn't have had this problem on their hands.
Right.
But the reason they have that problem is that they are still worshiping at this altar of false equivalency. You have to have one D and one R. Even if the D is trying to analyze an election, well, I think, you know, Biden needs to strengthen his support among young voters, or the war in Gaza will hurt him on his left flank. That's political analysis. And that person, whether it's David Axelrod or Claire McCaskill, whoever's on that that program now, is not trafficking in lies meant to undermine democracy. And it is significant both that Ronna McDaniel was doing that and that she was doing that from the position of leadership of one of our two major parties. And until you accept that one of our two major parties is committed to both the lie and the project of undermining and destroying American democracy, you're not going to understand the political climate, the political reality in which media outlets need to report on politics.
So Ron Emerson, we have Bill Curry on every week. And Bill Curry is a, you know, former politician from Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. But he says something really interesting. And that is that he's, and when we think about, for example, the Democratic Party, now is actually the two-party system. You've got the New Democrats, which are kind of pro-pharma and pro-Wall Street, and then the Progressive Democrats, which are like, you know, the Bernies and the Ro Khanas. Then you've got the Republican Party. And the Republican Party right now is a fascist party. So when we talk about democracy, I'm even trying to figure out how you even talk about Republicans. Because Republicans want to undermine democracy. They want to proliferate all the lies. They want to encourage hate. They want to encourage violence. They want, I mean, think about, they basically think they can cherry pick anything that a court says. I'll believe the court this time. I won't believe the court that time. I'll believe the law this time. I won't believe the law next time. So in a lot of ways, it is so difficult to even cover what is happening right now. Because frankly, if you want to cover democracy, you can only cover Democrats. And that's the New Democrats or the Progressive Democrats. And if you want to then throw in, you know, what's going on the fascist limb, you've got to actually call it that constantly, but don't basically think that it deserves the kind of coverage that I think you were just hearing, both from Laura Jadid and Lincoln Mitchell. And I think we need to be honest with Americans. There is a party that does not want to be democratic, that doesn't value the franchise, that doesn't value policy, that doesn't basically care whether you learn the facts or not. And they need to be put into a silo unto themselves, but not to use it as a compare and contrast with what Democrats are talking about, which really is the future and about policy. And frankly, about supporting something called democracy.
Yeah, there's a lot there, Arnie. So the first thing I would say is that threatening to bar a media outlet from a national convention to me is just feels like we're being threatened with a good time. You know, it is one less week of painful grimacing on the part of any of us who do value the truth. You know, all of these modern Republican principles seem to be situational, like you just said. You know, you believe the court when it's favorable. If you look at Trump's reactions to all his various litigation, he has taken shots at everyone except Judge Cannon, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the one judge who seems to, you know, just predictably help him out, you know, whenever she can, and sometimes, you know, beyond the pale of what any of us would expect in that sort of litigation. So, you know, I think Lincoln gave a little too much credit to the media in the sense that, you know, they're trying to be, you know, fair and balanced, to co-opt a phrase from one media outlet. I think they just care about ratings. I think the idea of putting Ronna McDaniel on MSNBC was meant to bring, you know, eyeballs from people like me who want to see the car wreck, you know, despite ourselves, and from people who may, you know, for a moment think, oh, okay, maybe these guys have something to say. And the first thing I thought when I heard the news about her being hired was, you know, just because Trump forced her out, in this case, the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. And that seemed to be, you know, a flawed premise in terms of what value she might bring. And she's caught between and betwixt. I mean, she seems to be a person with no real political or moral rudder. You know, everything is designed to benefit the party in the moment, yet she didn't do enough. And I think that has a lot to do with fundraising and funneling money to Trump's legal defense to placate him. So now, you know, they've taken over pretty much every significant facet of the Republican Party is in Trump's pocket. And we will see what happens with this next election. I think he's going to lose badly, and he's going to go on and on for another 4 years about how everything was rigged and, you know, illegals voted, and it's all just a, you know, big ploy to keep him from speaking truth to power.
Well, and let me just say something, Stephen Pair, and that is that not only am I frustrated with their decision to who they hire, because it feels like if you are an unhappy Republican, you immediately get hired by MSNBC, and therefore it's got the balance and the tenor of what we hear now on MSNBC doesn't feel even Democratic leaning. It just feels like moderate Republican leaning. But that's to be here or there. What bothers me though about the kind of coverage I see is that it's all about Trump's trial. And it's not about the policy that affects our lives. Someone was really cute. They said the other day, the reason we like your show, Arnie, is you talk about climate change. The reason why we like your show, Arnie, is that you talk about the cost of food. The reason, I mean, because I don't hear any of that. Those are the issues that ultimately, if you actually want to talk to the base, you don't need to remind them about Trump's trials. You don't have to be there every time, you know, he goes before a court. You need to talk about what is being threatened and what are the policies that we desperately need if we're going to have a viable future. But they don't talk about that because, to some extent, as Ron Abrams has said, perhaps it's not as sexy. Perhaps it doesn't get the ratings. But ultimately, what they're doing is they're in fact feeding exactly what Donald Trump wants, because he wants the attention 24/7, and they give it to him.
So there's a famous French aristocrat called Alexis de Tocqueville, who did a tour of the United States in the 1800s and wrote a big, thick book called Democracy in America, which is filled with a lot of things that he got really wrong, but a lot of keen insights. And one of the arguments that de Tocqueville made was that he talked about it in terms of newspapers, but we could talk about it in terms of journalism, that good journalism was itself necessary, not just for democracy, but for civilization itself, he argued, because absent a vehicle by which people in a democratic society could be provided with insight into what's going on and how to make choices about what will benefit themselves and their families and their communities, we cannot have functioning democratic institutions. It sits at the very heart of our ability to form together as a polity. Good journalism is a threat to authoritarian movements. NBC News is not a threat to authoritarian movements. They have demonstrated, as many of these national institutions have, over and over again, that they are not primarily journalistic institutions. I think Lincoln's observation that they are not propaganda outlets is the right one, but they are businesses before they are enterprises concerned with helping us all function in a democratic society. Don't think about this as a decision that NBC made. Think about this as a decision that Comcast made, right? And as I try sort of make sense of, you know, why would you bring in McDaniel? Is that, if you're looking for insight into the MAGA movement and connections, is that the right way to go? I'm not sure what those ties are. Laura may probably know this better than any of us. But it seems to me that that was part of an effort for them to prepare for a possible Trump presidency.
Yes.
And starting to build connections so that they could preserve their business interests. This was a business decision, not a journalism decision.
Oh my God, that's you nailed it. I mean, it's exactly what I'm thinking. And I want to also mention, because there was a U.S. senator who died this week, Joe Lieberman, and I've been listening again to MSNBC.
Is it wrong to say woohoo?
Well, wait, I'm close. The conversation was only positive, and nobody was allowed to utter anything that might even sort of look at his record. And again, I'm going to mention Bill Curry, because Bill Curry sat next to Joe Lieberman when he was originally in the state Senate in Connecticut. That's how long he's known Joe. But what he reminded all of us, and I think it's so important, that Joe Lieberman did more damage to the country almost single-handedly than any other U.S. senator. Why? And he pointed to two things. He was one of the biggest cheerleaders on the Democratic side for the war in Iraq. Okay? So that, I mean, absolutely went to the mat on this issue. Okay? That's number one. And think about the consequences of the war in Iraq. They are not only enormous to the United States, but to the world itself. And then the other thing he points out is the reason why we don't have a public option under the Affordable Care Act is that once again, who stepped up but Joe Lieberman to make sure that would never happen. And think about what that means for the consequences of folks who don't have access to healthcare, who go into bankruptcy because of it. We would be in such a different place. Not only did he make sure that we didn't get the public option, but there was even conversation about turning Medicare from 65 to 55. And when you want to know who was at the heart of the war and the public option, it was Joe Lieberman. So I want to remind everyone, everyone talks about him being at, you know, clinging to the center of what, Laura Jadid? Because in the end, that center was so destructive, it wasn't a center. It was a center that basically accommodated the military industrial complex and accommodated the big healthcare industry, but it didn't accommodate the American people. Oh,
absolutely.
Laura.
And frankly, there's a fetishization of the center in this country that I find extremely distressing. What is so great about the center? What is, if you have 50% rat poison and 50% sandwich, is that better than 100% sandwich? Like, this is, it's absurd. this absolute fetishization of the golden mean. And I feel like, oh, that comes back to MSNBC. This idea that the way to be objective is to find the center, and the way to find the center is to get people from both sides in here. No. This is, it's just ridiculous on the face of it. I'm sorry. I don't accept that the center is a good place to be. And I don't say, I think Lieberman is exhibit A.
Well, and I love your rat sandwich. You know, I mean, that was brilliant, because I always talk about the fact that, I mean, I'm going to toss to you next, Lincoln, because I know you want to talk about Lieberman. But I remember talking about the fact that we had a multimillionaire move into my community. Okay. And this was a town of 1,000 people. And all of a sudden the income, the average income in my community jumped by like 400%. Nobody saw a dime, but because we had this multimillionaire move into town and he was one of the 1,000, all of a sudden we all got richer. No, we did not. Anyway, Lincoln, you wanted to mention Joe Lieberman, and I just had to talk about it, because I've actually been in many rooms with Joe Lieberman, and as charming as everyone said, he also knew how to be lethal.
Yeah, I think there's another thing that has to be mentioned here about Joe Lieberman is, I think, the very complicated role he played in the American Jewish world, and also in presenting the American Jewry to the larger population. And I'm reminded of two things. One was, it wasn't just that he was the guy who stopped the public option. It wasn't always that he was the guy who really was the leading Democrat trying to stop Barack Obama from becoming president. Remember his flirtation with John McCain.
John McCain.
But it was the sense of self-righteousness. And grounding this in religiosity, when he was far to the right of most American Jews, and he gave cover to a lot of anti-Semites and on the Republican side, and frankly, to an extremely hawkish view of Israeli politics that is not the view of most American Jews. And look, I have to say, I am torn here. I don't like to speak ill of someone so recently dead, particularly because I know people in his family who I liked and who are kind of, you know, good people. So I don't want to say
like Kennedy's.
That,
but, I don't like RFK. Please.
Exactly.
Please.
Exactly. But also, the last thing he did publicly was to criticize Chuck Schumer for what I believe was one of the most important and best speeches by an American Jew about the state of Israel in recent times. And if you place yourself in a position where you think Chuck Schumer is anti-Israel, or Chuck Schumer is somehow an anti-Semite, you have really gone off of the deep end. And just one last thing, when he was nominated for vice president, I was watching his speech. This was a significant moment in the story of American Jewry. And he begins his speech with "Only in America." And this was before there was social media. So I yelled at my television, "Schmuck, the England had a Jewish prime minister in the 19th century. French had Leon Blum in the 1930s. Only in America did it take this long."
Yes, thank you so much. All right, we're going to have to go to a break. We only have a minute left. And when we come back, Ron Abramson, I want to talk about Baltimore. And I want to talk about Baltimore, not just because I want to talk about the huge cargo ship, not only because I want to talk about what happened to the bridge, not only because I want to talk about the fact that the mayor of Baltimore was being accused that this was an example of a DEI mayor failing Baltimore in the country, because he said that DEI now is the new N-word. It also came out to be a story about migration and immigration and the border. I mean, they everything stuck to this bridge. But that's one of the reasons why I want to toss to you when we come back. This, everyone, is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call it Rethink the Week. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
You frequently hear Trump apologists and MAGA cult members saying that the government is weaponizing the law against Trump. And if they can do this to him, they can do this to any of us. There is some truth to that. If you or me incited violence because we were trying to steal an election, the law would come after us. If you or me committed extensive real estate fraud, the law would come after us. You get the point. But there's another side to this. The truth is Trump gets a pass. He gets a pass on a lot of things. Let me just give you one example. Over the weekend, Trump circulated an image of the President of the United States, Joe Biden, being tied up and as if you're being kidnapped or worse. If you or I did that, we might well be against Biden or any president. We might well be investigated for making a threat against the president. That's a felony. There is an implicit threat in what Trump did. Where's the investigation? Where's the indictment? Just because Trump is facing 91 indictments doesn't mean that he gets a free pass on everything else.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Are frozen embryos children? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The recent Alabama case involved embryos created in vitro and accidentally destroyed at the fertility clinic where they were being preserved. There, as is typical in vitro fertilization, an egg and a sperm were joined in a lab to create an embryo that can be stored for decades. The adult sued under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that the fact that the embryos had existed only in a lab and had never been implanted in a uterus was irrelevant. They said that the laboratory embryos were children, unborn children, regardless of their, in the court's words, location. The rationale? Life begins at fertilization. Those fertilized eggs in the lab were children, unborn children, in the Chief Justice's words, little people. In response to the in vitro decision, the Alabama legislature passed a law that protects IVF clinics from lawsuits. But the Alabama case and its rationale remain. Under Dobbs, that's the Supreme Court case that reversed Roe v. Wade, women no longer have the right to make their own reproductive choices. That decision is now up to the government. So, what used to be a woman's right to choose is now a matter of legislative roulette. And as the croupier says at the table, round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. When do we tape it? We tape it on Friday morning. So I'm going to toss to you, Ron Abramson. We're being rejoined by Stephen Pimper, Lincoln Mitchell, Ron Abramson, and Laura Jadid. And Ron is the immigration lawyer in this panel. And Ron, there are so many stories swirling around after the bridge collapsed in Baltimore. And I have a couple of them in front of me, and I just want to sort of thread them and then give you an opportunity to sort of talk. One was a story that I saw at Salon.com. Quote, "They don't have the courage to say the N-word. Baltimore mayor rips right-wing DEI mayor attacks. Right-wingers smear Brandon Scott, who is elected with over 70% as a diversity hire after the Key Bridge collapse." And then, of course, people who care about, you know, the old form of fuel, the Port of Baltimore closure shuts down the number two U.S. coal export hub, which, you know, should get a lot of people in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Tennessee pretty upset about that. But, of course, they're now even talking about whether they're going to help rebuild it. We're hearing that from the Republicans. And of course, we also know that a number of the individuals that were filling the potholes that died, they come from Salvador, Mexico, Honduras. And now all of a sudden, this is a border problem, a migrant problem, an immigration problem. But before we even get to that, Ron Abramson, I was looking at an interview that I saw where they were interviewing someone about the Baltimore Bridge collapse. And they went to someone who's actually an expert in shipping. And this was, I thought this was just such a huge ship. You know, where were the tugboats? How could they have stopped it? Was this bridge prepared to take anything quite so big going under this bridge that was built 50 years ago? And listen to this number and nugget that I got out of this article, Ron. The Dolly, which was the ship that hit the bridge, is 900 feet long. It weighs 115,000 tons. But then they wanted to put it into comparison. And remember what happened in the Suez Canal where that shipping boat basically got stuck and they couldn't open it up because it went, I guess, went parallel or horizontal in the Suez Canal. It turns out that shipping boat was called the Ever Given. And it was 1,300 feet long. Remember, the Dolly is only 900 feet long and it weighed 200,000 tons. The Dolly carried 10,000 containers. The Ever Given carried 20,000. And this was the part that blew my mind. The Dolly doesn't even come close to registering as a big container ship. It's basically a medium-sized one. So as we look at everyone pointing blame, as we look at the bridge, as we look at what happened with the anchor, what happened with the tug, what happened when it stopped working. I mean, I want people to understand the size and scope of what we're talking about now in the shipping industry and looking at most of the bridges in America, which are 50 years old. No one ever envisioned anything like this, but look at how commerce is being operated today. But instead of addressing what needs to change, we're pointing fingers of blame. And once again, as you pointed out before we even began the show, if it's a 2024 election, it all goes back to the border and immigration.
Before we get into that, could anyone on the panel remind me what Trump accomplished during Infrastructure Week?
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know that we ever got around to that. And look at where we are. Although this may not have as much to do with a failing infrastructure as it may be, God forbid, an accident. It could just be a very tragic accident. But we don't live in a world or in a society where we allow for that. We have to ascribe blame. We have to come up with conspiracy theories. We have to make this someone's fault, because if we're not vilifying someone, we don't know that we exist. It's sort of a, you know, Cartesian reinvention. You know, we vilify, therefore we are. So to bring it back to immigration, this sort of situation always reminds me of the meme that's gone around about Schrodinger's immigrant. You know, the one who is simultaneously sponging off the welfare system while stealing our jobs. And, you know, we have industry after industry after industry that relies on non-US born labor, would love to hire people who are here legally with permission to work, but can't, because our immigration system, which was, conceived in the 1950s, doesn't work in the, first quarter of the 21st century. It just doesn't account for the global world we're in, the paucity of American workers at both ends of the skill continuum, you know, the lower end and the highest end. And, you know, all of my clients, business clients, would rather not have to hire me to figure out how to employ the people they need to run their US businesses. Every single one of them. They may think I'm a nice guy. They don't love getting invoices. They don't love the unpredictability. They don't love me telling them, if all goes well, you'll have this person a year and a half from now. We are so selectively capitalistic and so hypocritical about our capitalist system when it comes to immigration that, you know, I joke that I don't meet with people in my office. I meet with them in conference rooms because my office has all the dents in the wall from where I beat my head against it. And it's just unsightly. So does it surprise me that this turned into a vilification of, you know, immigrants, non-citizens, whatever you term you want to use? No. Does it still appall me after all these years? Absolutely. And, you know, we have people who are doing the dirtiest jobs in America because no one else will. And they have made this, you know, effectively Faustian bargain that doing these terrible jobs and making a pittance of a wage is still better than not working or being in danger of gangs or corrupt police or whatever it is from where they come. And, you know, the whole southern border thing, that's a complete different episode. I don't think I want to get into that because you won't shut me up. It is not surprising. And all this, you know, coded language is not even really coded. I think I take exception with the fact that people are afraid to say the N-word, so they're saying DEI. I see the N-word bandied about on social media all the time. Right. And some people are just, you know, slightly more filtered than others. But of course we know what this all means. And we all know what the dog whistles are. And what happened in 2016 is the dog whistles worked. And here we are in 2024, still dealing with that.
So Stephen Pimper, one of the things that I think is just so shocking is that when you look at who depends on so many of the undocumented immigrants in America, it is some of the biggest, wealthiest, most successful corporations in America. Think of the agribusiness, okay? Think of Cargill and Conag. I mean, Cargill may be the biggest company on the planet. We don't know because it's privately owned. Let's take a look at, for example, what's going to be happening with the rebuilding of infrastructure. And I told this story last week. I'll tell it again over and over again, is that when we went down to help with the rebuilding after Katrina, what did we see in New Orleans, Stephen Pimper? We saw t-shirts that were being sold. And the t-shirt said, FEMA, find every Mexican available, because that's what was rebuilt. New Orleans. All right. So now I'm looking at what happened in Baltimore. And then I'm realizing how much money did Joe Biden put into his infrastructure bill that Donald Trump threatened but never accomplished. And it wasn't just about rebuilding infrastructure. It was about remanufacturing. It was what he was going to be doing in places like Tennessee. So we have a huge amount of money being poured into building and construction and planning for our future economy. Where are we going to find the warm bodies to do it? Because no one anticipated Baltimore when we were looking at this huge investment across the United States to reinvest in rebuilding an infrastructure that we have ignored for decades. But I'm telling you right now, I'm not looking at Baltimore as a problem of money. I am looking at Baltimore as, where are they going to find the human beings to do it? And unless we have the business community standing with the immigration community, standing with progressives, standing with people that understand what's happening in every aspect of our economy, they're going to be able to vilify, but ultimately we're going to destroy the economy, Stephen Pimper. This is not just about human beings. It's about the future of whether we're able to cope and exist, and we don't have the capacity to do it.
And this is more than just availability of labor story as well. There was a fairly thoughtful story this past week in the Christian Science Monitor about declining birth rates, right? And this is something that's happening not just in the United States, but around the world. It's often a thing that comes when societies get richer for a whole lot of complicated reasons. It may be because of unaffordability of housing, all sorts of things at work there, right? But why this matters right, is that despite the fact that most people think that Social Security is essentially a savings account, right? They put their money in their account and it accumulates value so that they can draw on it when they retire. That's not how Social Security works. Social Security is an intergenerational transfer program. It's people who are currently working are paying for the retirement benefits of people collecting Social Security. And one of the long-term challenges with how we structure that program is that we do not have enough people working, putting payroll taxes into the system. So if anybody listening to this would like to retire someday and feel confident that that program will be sufficiently funded, for that selfish reason, if for none other, you should be in favor of radically expanding opportunities for legal migration and allowing people to work.
Well, on top of that, Laura Jadid, here's the other dirty little secret about undocumented immigrants. Right now, undocumented immigrants, a lot of them have fake Social Security cards until they get their cover from their boss, okay? So their boss can say, oh, no, they show me. And it turns out that guess what? They probably contribute about $13 billion to Social Security that they will never be able to retrieve. So if we want to know who's propping up Social Security, everyone keeps talking about how they're a drain on everything. Well, I don't know about you, but the last time an undocumented immigrant was able to pay a sales tax or a liquor tax or this tax, or I mean, let's not create this fiction about them that they're only a drain. They're in fact the exact opposite, including propping up Social Security. So you hear from Stephen, we need more people working in order to make sure that Social Security survives. But also I want people to understand there is this fiction about what it is that they do, and it is a fiction. And yet at the same time, here is an opportunity with this bridge to actually have a moment where we can have clarification about what it is we need as a nation to be successful. And that is to figure out that we have to change our immigration policy. We have to create legal opportunities and legal paths for people so they don't have to work in the shadows. And that we have to recognize if you want to be able to afford your food and you're complaining about inflation, then elect Donald Trump and he'll pick up all those undocumented workers and he's going to ship them out of the country. And your lettuce just went up by 300%. And this is an opportunity to talk about it, but we hear nothing, Laura. We hear nothing because the Democrats are frankly as afraid as the Republicans are fearless.
The Democrats have completely abandoned the immigration issue, and it makes me sick. And it's not, it makes me sick for moral reasons primarily. It also makes no political sense. It doesn't. They will always be the second best anti-immigrant party. Always. I don't care what they do. So why would they take this ground? Public opinion is shifting on immigrants. It is shifting anti-immigrant. And one of the reasons it's doing it is because the Democrats have abandoned the issue. They are telling voters that, yes, you're right. It is a huge problem that these masses of people are coming into this country who want a better life. People who have the get up and go to leave their whole culture behind and cross a border so that they can work awful jobs for awful wages so that they can claw their way up in this world. I'm the daughter of an immigrant. My father came over from Syria and he loved this country more than just about anyone I've ever known. These are the people we want here. These are the real Americans. And it is shameful that the Democrats have abandoned this.
Well, I just see this as just such an incredible opportunity, because when they talk about how many years and how many billions of dollars, and they're talking about it as if it's only a dollar and cents, it's not. We need human beings to build these things. That's what we don't understand. We look at what happened with, you know, so much of the profit that corporations were able to make during the pandemic. 90% of it went to stockholders, not to the workers that continued to work during the pandemic. We never look at them as if somehow they're invisible. And that's with workers that have, you know, that were born in America. What about if you're undocumented? You're completely invisible. All right, we need to change the subject, Lincoln. And that is, I want to talk about RFK's pick for his VP. Because again, we have to talk about the fact that, you know, names are so important. And, you were friends with, you know, there's some really good Liebermans, and I'm sure there are, and there's some really good Kennedys, and I'm sure there are, but RFK Jr., I'm not sure he's one of them. And then with his decision to punt on Aaron Rodgers and Jesse Ventura, it's not shocking, because Nicole Shanahan offers him something that neither Jesse nor Aaron Rodgers could do. One is probably a checkbook that you and I would probably go like, oh my God. And actually, you know what else is sort of interesting about Nicole? Not only does she have no political resume, not only I think is she a vegan and anti-IVF and all these other things, but it turns out that when she got a divorce from her very, very successful rich husband, who was one of the founders of Google, part of the rationale for the divorce was that she was having what? An affair with Elon Musk. I mean, if I was writing a Saturday Night Live script, I couldn't have created a character better than his VP pick. But yet, look what RFK has done. And I think Democrats should be afraid because he's playing the Kennedy name, and now she has the cash to help him promote it.
You know, I was hoping to offer some serious thoughts on immigration. Then you pulled me into Bobby Kennedy Jr., but I'll
do my
best.
I'm so sorry.
I will say that
I think his
student
running mate is doing jobs Americans won't do. You know, she's that's got right. An immigrant background, so there she's filling
so
that
there's
space.
The connection. There's the link.
Really. Oh, I love you, Ron. Okay, keep going.
And I'm not going to make a pun about punting in Aaron Rodgers because I don't really know enough about football. But it's there's a lot here, right? This is clearly now moves into the realm of, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was never serious about becoming president, and this is further evidence of that. But it does, not only does she have money, and let's be clear, that money will likely go to a super PAC, not to the campaign itself, the same super PAC presumably that paid for that very strange, but I thought very good Super Bowl commercial. So that is significant. And to say she has money is an understatement. If you are Sergey Brin's ex-wife, you effectively, even though I don't think the terms of the settlement are public, I think we could say she has infinite amounts of money, right? I mean, basically infinitely deep pockets. I'm not going to go near the Elon Musk affair because I think whoever people sleep with, even if it displays just extraordinarily terrible judgment, is their own business.
I'm not worried about her bad judgment. I'm just looking at Elon Musk as the expert here.
But there is something else here, which is that when you pick a vice president, even if you're a real candidate, like, you know, Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris, what you're doing is presenting an image of how you want to be understood. And here's where I think it could be damaging.
Yes.
Because who she speaks to is that kind of tech, you know, not quite the angry tech libertarian Muskian Gary Tan kind of pro-fascist approach, but more the kind of we're smart, have answers view of all of this. And I think Nicole Shanahan brings that a little bit, and that will reach kind of some affluent voters who otherwise would lean towards the Democrat. Also, because it's very clear now that despite Robert F. Kennedy's kind of anti-vax and other strange positions, he is presenting like somebody more on the far left than on the far right, and that will also hurt Biden. I will go back to another question here, which I think I've raised on this show before. Third-party candidates tend to peak in the late spring, the exception being really 1860, but that was a while ago, and that was Abraham Lincoln. And I don't really think Robert F. Kennedy is the next Abraham Lincoln. But third-party candidates tend to peak in the late spring. And then what happens is the pressure to go back to your party that has a chance of winning gets to be very strong. So the question we need to focus on here is not how many votes will Robert F. Kennedy Jr. get nationally. That is irrelevant. Most of those votes will come in California and New York. Those will be his two strongest states. Doesn't matter. Biden's carrying those two states. Will his margin be enough to affect the outcome in a handful of states? And that could be Michigan, it could be Wisconsin, could be Arizona, et cetera, et cetera. The answer there is very probably. You know, we don't know for sure, but to not take that threat seriously is a mistake. The way you turn that very probably into pretty unlikely is you go after Robert F. Kennedy and you expose who he is and you expose and you just keep hitting and hitting that a vote for him is a vote for Trump. And that's how you minimize third-party candidates. But that doesn't happen by magic. You have to do it. Doesn't hurt to begin doing it sooner. And you can turn the Shanahan nomination into a negative because it shows this is just a protest, a weird, quirky protest vote.
Well, and let me just say something, Ron. So I think the whole abortion, birth control, mifepristone, IVF is going to be a huge issue. We saw that in Alabama, okay? And when we saw that in Alabama, I think we were like, oh my God, it was a Republican district. She won by 25 points. This was Alabama. She was all IVF and all abortion. That was her entire campaign. And she went door to door and it worked. It resonated. And she saw lots of women show up. And if I am going to attack Kennedy as a result of what's just happened, I think one of the things I would do is I would quote the following two sentences from an article that I just read at Politico. Robert F. Kennedy's running mate has been a harsh critic of in vitro fertilization while funding alternative research on extending women's reproductive years. Nicole Shanahan has for years denounced IVF, calling it one of the biggest lies that's being told about women's health today. And again, Ron, after watching what the Alabama legislature started doing, the backstroke on the IVF thing when their Supreme Court made that decision, then you see this woman running on this issue. If you want to attack Kennedy, you don't go after only Kennedy. You go after the person who's going to be writing the checks, who's going to ultimately elevate him. And not only is he an anti-vaxxer, but look at Nicole. Nicole is against IVF. And I think this is a way of connecting, and it becomes an important code for women. This is someone you can't embrace under any set of circumstances. It's not only that he will elevate Trump. What does it mean for you and your lives and your future?
I think almost by definition, you know, anyone who would have agreed to be RFK Jr.'s running mate is sort of a, you know, Groucho Marx situation. Like, how could you possibly take seriously somebody who would accept that, you know, position, that charge? I mean, that's nothing more than a chance to promote a personal agenda, you know, publicly for a few months before the whole thing fades out. I do appreciate the chance to, you know, that you're asking me to mansplain some of the women's choice issues. I feel very honored about that. But seriously, I think, I mean, this is where we are. And, yes, you know, the Republicans have sort of two strategies. You know, one is to just club everybody over the head with their, you know, conservative, in quotes, ideology. And the other is to seek to fix as much of the system as they can to their own advantage, whether it's the courts, whether it's gerrymandering, whether it's limiting absentee voting. You know, all of this litigation that's going on right now, every Republican court case related to elections is about limiting access to the ballot. You started this program by talking about how there's really only one party trafficking in democracy right now. And we're seeing it week in, week out with all these news reports.
I don't want mansplaining, because I think the abortion, the IVF, the mifepristone, this is our collective issue. You know that, and I know
it's
that.
A human rights issue.
It's a human right. And what did the French say when they incorporated abortion into their constitution? That abortion is actually an important function of democracy. They didn't talk about it as a women's issue. They talk about it as a democratic issue. It is about equality. It is about democracy. And so I think sometimes I'm not asking anyone to mansplain. I want them to understand that this is a continuity of what it is we talk about, by both human rights as well as, if we want to promote democracy, how do we not promote this access to equality? And I think that that's also important. I don't want this to have a female gender relationship. I want this to be more universal.
People cannot be full political and economic citizens if they can't make choices about whether, when, or if to have children.
Yes.
Right. I wanted to say one thing about RFK, because sort of the thing that has caused me not to worry about him in the past is that he doesn't seem to be any good at gathering money. And the principal challenge of third party candidates is always ballot access. Right. He's now got the money, presumably. So here are the dates to look at. July 5th is the deadline for getting on the ballot in Nevada. July 9th for Georgia, August 1 for Pennsylvania, August 6th for Wisconsin, August 17th for Arizona, August 31 for Michigan. I would keep my eye on those dates, because those are likely the states that are most going to matter, where just that difference along the margin, as Lincoln observed, could make the difference in the election. If he gets on those ballots, that's a problem. If he doesn't get on those ballots, I think we can safely not pay too much attention.
But that's the reason why everyone needs to know about who he is, because you want to make sure that as he approaches this ballot question, we can't wait to describe him, to show how toxic he is, to talk about what he believes and say, is this what you want on your ballot? I mean, again, you're giving me dates, but you're giving me reason why the Democrats can't just wait in case he becomes a problem. They have to act quickly and swiftly now, because he doesn't have to spend time raising the money. It's there, Stephen. Am I right?
I don't necessarily disagree. I perennially worry about is the risk of that we elevate him and bring him to attention in ways that he wouldn't otherwise gather attention. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Oh God, this is why politics is so difficult. You
know,
do you want to ignore?
RFK is an absolute freak, and I think the more people see of him, the better.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Look, that's my sentiment, Laura, but we're the two girls on this panel. Anyway, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Hardison and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week. I want to thank Laura Janine. I want to thank Stephen Pepea, Ron Abramson, and Lincoln Mitchell for joining us. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You may-